All right, well, if you will, why don't you turn to 1 Samuel chapter 8. That will be our text for this morning, and let's start with verses 1 through 3. And it came about when Samuel was old, and he appointed his sons judges over Israel. And now the name of his firstborn was Joel, and the name of his second Abijah, and they were judging in Beersheba. His sons, however, did not walk in his ways, but turned aside after dishonest gain and took bribes and perverted justice. All right, so basically we see our story here. It opens up kind of setting the backstory for the broader text that we'll be looking at. But before we jump into that, I want to actually put kind of the backstory to that to make sure we're all kind of at the same point together. And so first is, I think it's very important that we all realize at this particular time, Israel is a theocratic state, right? So that is a system of government where a deity, in this case, obviously God, is recognized as the supreme ruling authority, and laws are interpreted and managed by the religious leaders. And for Israel, the law, the Torah, served as both the religious code and the civil code for the land. And then the priests and elders would help administer that code, make decisions between disputes, etc. And, you know, all this works really well when everybody's eyes are focused on God. I mean, that's why, you know, a theocratic state, that, you know, the whole intention is keeping your eyes on God, always pointing to God at the top. But unfortunately, there's humans always in the system, right? And as humans, we get distracted, we lose track. And that actually is characteristic of the whole 300 years here between Joshua and Samuel. In fact, it's characterized by this constant cycle over and over again. Starts with sin, usually the people going off and beginning to worship other gods. Then follows very quickly with judgment. God judges the people, usually involving some kind of oppression from one of their neighboring countries. And then, of course, distress. The people call out, for God's mercy. And God always relents and shows his mercy to the people. And then, you know, that goes well for a little bit of time, and then things start to tail off again, and they start back in that negative cycle again. And so usually mercy in this cycle is shown in the way of God raising up a judge. And that judge then will help bring the eyes of the people back to God. And then from there, God will work through that judge to help throw off the oppression that they are feeling. And usually in very miraculous ways does God do this in terms of throwing off those oppressing forces. And this is really what happened last week, right? With Samuel, you might remember. Samuel is the latest in the line of judges. Actually, he's the very last judge. And we saw, you know, Samuel was a very strong judge. He, like others, turned the eyes of the Israelites back to God. And then with, obviously, the help of God, miraculous help of God, then he threw off the oppression of the Philistines. So that's kind of the backstory, if you will. Now, the backstory to this particular passage that we see here in the first three verses. And basically what we see is the problem introduced that we're going to be dealing with, and that is Samuel's son. Samuel had appointed them to be judges over Israel. However, they abused that. They were perverting justice that they were supposed to be upholding. And so here we again kind of see this cycle kind of starting up again. Right now, you know, with Samuel, they've been kind of on the top of the apex doing well, but now, you know, we're seeing bad leadership and starting to direct their eyes away from God, and it's a problem. And it's also important to note here that Samuel was the one who appointed his sons over Israel. Well, there's a problem with that, because it was not Samuel's role to be able to appoint a judge. That is solely the responsibility of God. God did that in times of need. God was responsible for assigning that. It was not judgeship was not something that was transferred by a lineage. And so what happened here is, and it kind of makes sense. We see that, you know, Samuel's getting old, and he was thinking, hey, you know, I'm not able to get to all my duties. I'm having a hard time keeping up. I think it'd be a good idea to maybe assign my sons as judges. So we can see how this happened. And maybe it was a good idea, but what wasn't a good idea is first asking God if he wanted this to happen. And certainly God would have said, hey, I know the hearts of your sons. This is not a good idea. So we see ultimately that Samuel's poor judgment precipitates this problem that he finds himself in now, or that he is about to find himself in. And this is the subject of the rest of the passage. And so as we read further, what you're going to see is that basically it's dialogue. It's dialogue between the Israelites, Samuel, and God and Samuel, Israelites, and back and forth. Okay? So let's see where it goes from here. To chapter 8, verse 4. And then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. And they said to him, behold, you have grown old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint a king for us to judge us like all the other nations. So, again, the trouble, problem were Samuel's sons and their perverting of the justice. And so now we see this dialogue beginning. And the dialogue here is beginning between the people and the Israelites, the people, their elders, and Samuel. And we see, again, this problem, and that basically they've had enough. They're tired of it. They want a change. In fact, they want a really big change now. They want a king. And so they go to Samuel. And I think the idea here is that Samuel obviously has to go to God and get all of this approved, right? And so they go to Samuel, and, I think they have a very legitimate beef, right? That basically, you know, Samuel's sons, they're perverting justice. They have every right to challenge the authority of Samuel's sons and their dishonesty. I might even go so far as to say, you know, I give them credit, the elders credit, that they are being proactive here. They see a problem. They see, the bad leadership. It's going to start, taking people's eyes off of God. And so they're being proactive. That's good. The elders request a king may not necessarily be all that bad of a request in all, because actually God makes provision for a king in the Torah, in the law. In Deuteronomy 17, chapter 17, verse 14, when you enter the land which the Lord your God gives you, and you possess it, and you live in it, and you say, I will set a king over me like all the other nations who are around me. And you shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses. And so God, we see here, God makes that provision. He realizes at some point there will be a king over my people. I will set a king over my people. So that's not all bad, right? There is a need for a change, and maybe a king would be the right thing. However, there are two clear issues with this request. And I think the first one's pretty obvious to us all, right? And that's the motivation behind it. What do they say is their motivation for a king? Now appoint us a king for us to judge us like what? Like all the nations. They want to be like all the nations. And it's kind of interesting, this is exactly what we see, you know, God kind of warning or telling them in Deuteronomy chapter 17, right? That, you know, at some point you're going to want a king just like all the other nations. God knew their heart, knew what was going to happen before they even got there. And, I think it's the interesting part of this is what do you think the people were seeing in all the pagan countries around them and the leadership and, you know, how they treated their people? I'm not sure what they were seeing that would want them to be like the other nations, but apparently there was still something that they saw. But that's not so much the problem. I think the real problem stems, and the sad part of this is they were trampling on one of God's deepest desires for his people that he expresses in Deuteronomy chapter 7, verse 6. He says, "For you are a holy people to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you to be a people for his own possession out of all the peoples who are on the face of the earth." So God, this relationship, the way God feels to them is very special. In fact, he calls for them to be holy. What does that mean? Set apart. They are to be different. He wants them to be different because they belong to him. And they're just trampling all over this. They, you know, it's like, we don't want to be so different. We want to be more like everybody else. And I wonder if, you know, it's the same thing as Christians, right? We're called similarly. Frank was in 1 Peter chapter 2. Similarly in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 9. "But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who has called you out of darkness into his marvelous light." So in the same way we are called to be holy and set apart for God's purpose as Christians. And so, you know, how sad it is when we as Christians kind of fall back and kind of think, I just want to be like everyone else. No, we want to be separate. We want to be separate for God's purpose. So here we see this first problem with their request, their motivation. Now there's actually a second cause, and we'll get to that in just a minute. We need to read a little bit further, and that will become very apparent. So if you'll bear and be patient, we'll get to that in a moment. All right, so here we've seen basically the people giving their request, their dialogue to Samuel, saying, this is what we want. And a big problem with that is the motivation behind it. Now let's see where we go from there. Let's take a look at verses 6 through 8. Okay. But now this thing was displeasing in the sight of Samuel when they said, "Give us a king to judge us." And Samuel prayed to the Lord, and the Lord said to Samuel, "Listen to the voice of the people in regard to all that they say to you. For they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. Like all the deeds which they have done since the day that I brought them up out of Egypt, even to this day, in that they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also." Okay, so here we see the dialogue continue, right? So the people have talked to Samuel. Now we see Samuel talking to God, and then God corresponding with Samuel. But first, we see that Samuel first begins relaying the message of the people to God. And from this, we see that the passage is clear. This was displeasing in the sight of Samuel. He was displeased with that. And yeah, in fact, I kind of imagine, you know, Samuel took this request pretty personally. You know, they say, well, give us a king to judge us. You know, did Samuel, well, what am I, chopped liver or something? You know, and it's, you're too old and your sons are too corrupt. Out with the old, in with the new. You can see that, you know, Samuel would be hurt. He would, you know, feel really rejected. And usually what is our response to feeling rejected like this, to be treated this way? Well, it's usually to fire back, right? You know, sure, you know, get back at him or say, well, have you thought about this or whatever? But that wasn't Samuel's response. And to Samuel's credit, what did he do? He kept his mouth shut, and then he prayed to God. What a powerful example for us that he just prayed. What if we could just stop and pray every time we need to respond to some displeasing interaction we have with somebody, right? What if I just had prayed before I lashed out? Or what if I had just prayed before I wrote that scathing email? Or what if I prayed, or if I just prayed before I even responded? Even if I responded lovingly to that person, but, you know, I only gave a half-baked solution to them. So, I mean, Samuel is showing us a very beautiful response to this rejection that the people are showing him. So Samuel is conveyed. Now he prays to God, and he conveys the people's request to God. And so now we see here that God listens to the heart of the request. In your notes there, God listens to the heart of the request. And by that, first off, before God, in God's response, I think it's also important to note here his compassion that he shows to Samuel. I kind of think this might be like a situation maybe, or, you know, I can kind of see this in my mind. Maybe two old presidents, you know, former presidents, you know, that maybe are getting called together for some big state activity or something, and before they're on or whatever, they're hanging out together, having coffee together, and just kind of talking about the war stories and how people treated them and being rejected and dealing with, you know, state matters. I kind of get this feel between, you know, Samuel and God. This dialogue here is kind of in that same vein. And, you know, God could have, you know, lashed out at Samuel and said, you know, this is really all your fault. You should have never appointed your sons as judges. What in the world were you thinking, Samuel? But that wasn't God's approach. Rather, God chooses to console Samuel. And I think this is a very beautiful thing. It says, you know, they haven't rejected you. They've rejected me. And I'm sorry that, they're treating you the very same way they've been treating me ever since we left Egypt, right? So God first consoles Samuel and considers Samuel in his response. And I think that's very beautiful. And but God doesn't end there. God actually responds to the request of the Israelites. And my guess is that, at least if I had not known the story beforehand, I would have been a little surprised by God's response. And what was that? Listen to the voice of the people in regard to all that they say to you. So God says, listen, listen. Even though this is a bad request, we can see that. God nevertheless tells him to listen. And what does God say specifically? He says to listen to all that they have to say. And I think that all is very important here, in the sense is what God is saying is it's not just enough to listen to what they are saying, what they're verbalizing, but also to listen to the heart. Because that's kind of what God addresses as he continues to speak here. So God is listening to the heart of the request, as well as to what the head, the verbal part of the request. And I think that that's really the second problem with their request. Remember, the first part was the motivation, right? The request in itself may be okay, but the motivation, and now really the heart of the request, is where the problem is at. And that is basically, as we've read here, that, and God points out, they've rejected God as their king. But I think it goes even beyond this. It goes beyond just being the king, the governor, the one governing, there we go, of the country. And why I say that is that look at God, what he says here in verse 9. And watch, if it goes, that's verse 8, or chapter 8. Verse 8 in chapter 9. Chapter 8, I'm sorry. I'm looking at the top of the thing there. Okay. So, like all the deeds which they have done since the day that I brought them up out of Egypt, even to this day, in that they have forsaken me and served other gods. Like all the deeds. What does that sound like? Well, it's kind of like the motivation, right, of the request, like all the other nations. I think God is playing on this, like all the, right? And here, God's trying to make the point that, my provision for you is nothing like all the other nations' gods. That is, that ever since I've taken or helped you out of Egypt and then have taken care of you ever since up to this point, I have, you know, I have defeated all of these other gods, right? In miraculous ways, I've brought them down. I have always been there for you, right? And then what do I get? The people lack to fully appreciate God having been there, God's miraculous deeds, God's always there. Rather, when things get rough, what do the people do? They tend to lack the trust in God, even with his miraculous deeds. So, and then again, you know, he brings up even more insulting than all of that, their lack of trust. Then they turn to other gods to try to fill this perceived gap of security. So here we see the ultimate issue, and this is the ultimate issue with their request, is that, you know, their heart isn't on God. They're not looking to God. They're not trusting in God. Basically, they're trading Big King, capital K, God King, for a little lowercase king, a human king. They're not making God their ultimate authority. They're not trusting solely in God. And that's what their heart is saying, and that's what God is hearing. And so here, again, God is listening both to what they're saying. He's also hearing the heart as well. So God listens to the heart of the request. So what can we take away from this for ourselves? And here it is, it's, you know, if God is listening to the heart of the request, how careful am I about thinking about and realizing, what am I asking God? What is the heart of my request? And how do I even know what the heart of my request is? Is there times, like we see here, when my head, my verbalized request is really kind of different than what my heart request is? How do I know when those are off and then I'm really making a bad request to God? Well, I think there's five things that we can see here from the Israelites that would send up some red flags that maybe our head and our heart are misaligned and we're making a bad request of God. The first here that we see is there's actually some good merit, right? There's some merit to their request to begin with. That is, you know, there is a need to change, right? That, you know, Samuel's sons have perverted justice. So there is some need to change, and a king may be an appropriate change for that. But just because there is some merit to the request doesn't make the whole request meritorious, right? And so we need to be careful and look at the whole request and think about the request in its entirety. That just because part of it's meritorious doesn't mean it all is. And so we need to be very careful about looking at the whole request and the value of it. Another issue that I see here with the Israelites that we can make the same issue is that is when we come to God with a very strong opinion to start with, and that's what they've done here. We want a king. And, you know, and we will see that, you know, they're going to become more and more entrenched in this request and what they want being the king. In fact, they fixate on having a king. And so, again, I would say this is another red flag, is when you start, rather than it being a request, it almost becomes a demand. You're basically telling God, I know what's best. And that's obviously a place where maybe your head and what you're verbalizing is very different from your heart, is if your request is a demand instead of a request. And so this is another red flag I think we can see here when we're making a bad request to the Lord. A third thing I think is, again, we can see here, we've talked a little bit about, and that's whether this request stems from a lack of trust in God. And this is a very insidious problem, I think, or at least I know for me, I have to be careful of. And I imagine the Israelites, if we'd asked them, are you trying to replace God or rejecting God? And they would say, no, we're just simply, we want a lowercase king. We want someone to govern us here, right? We're not trying to replace God, King, capital King, right? But I think sometimes we're guilty of making requests because we, or the way we make our requests, because we don't trust God to give us the strength to endure the outcome, right? So the way we ask, maybe it's health. You know, I want to be healed. And I state it that way, and it's out of a lack of trust because I don't trust that God will give me the strength if I don't get well, right? You follow what I'm saying? And that's the case here. So we need to be very careful of whether our requests are, you know, stem out of a lack of trust for God, as we see here with the Israelites. Again, another issue where our head and our heart may not be aligned very well, and that's the motivation. We saw that with the Israelites. They wanted to be like the other nations. Well, what about us? Well, what is our motivation? And again, can be very insidious. It looks good on the surface, but down below, is it, you know, pride? Is it jealousy that's really driving my request? Again, place where the mind, the head, and the heart may not align, and we're not asking what we really need to be asking from God. And then the fifth one is a failure to clearly evaluate your culpability in the current situation. Let me explain what I mean by there. And that, again, back to the Israelites, we see this with them, right? What are they blaming the problem on? The need for a change is because of Samuel's sons, their perversion of justice. We need to make a change because of that. But, and yes, that is a problem, but that's not the ultimate problem. This is just a symptom of a much broader problem, and that is the people's heart, the people's eyes being on God, and that is the problem. And so do we ever ask something and not, you know, realize that there's really something we need to change before we make that ask? And that's the case here. They really need to get their hearts right with God before they start making these other requests. So do I have something to do with the situation that I need to change first before going forward with my request? So here we can see five different ways that we can see from this particular case how what they thought they were asking was different from what their heart was asking. Yet God listens to that heart. And we can make mistakes in what we're asking. And we want to make good requests of God. So, again, God not only listens to our verbal requests, he listens to our heart, the heart of our request. So we need to be careful about what we're asking. Okay, so God's heard not only what they ask, you know, with their mouth, but also with their heart. Now we're going to see what God's response is. And in fact, we see God listens and he warns. God listens and he warns. So let's pick up in verse 9. Now then, listen to their voice. This is God speaking. However, you shall solemnly warn them that they and tell them of the procedure of the king who will reign over them. So Samuel spoke all the words of the Lord to the people who asked of him a king. He said, this will be the procedure of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and place them for himself in his chariots and among his horsemen, and they will run before his chariot. And he will appoint for himself commanders of thousands and of fifties, and some to do his plowing and to reap his harvest and make his weapons of war and equip for his chariots. He will also take your daughters for their for perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and your vineyards and your olive groves and give them to his servants. And he will take a tenth of your seed and all and of your vineyards, and he will give to his officers and his servants. He will also take your male servants and your female servants, and your best young man and your donkeys, and use them for his work. He will also take a tenth of your flocks, and you yourselves will become his servants. Then you will cry out in that day because of your king whom you have chosen for yourselves, but the Lord will not answer you in that day. Okay, so here we see the dialogue continuing. First, we see the dialogue finishing up between God and Samuel. God's giving some special instructions that he wants in terms of how Samuel is, you know, to convey his message. And then we see the dialogue switching from Samuel to Israel in response to their request. So first, we see the instructions from God to Samuel. And I think it's important that it begins with what? Now listen to their voice. So God tells him to listen, and it's just interesting to note that we've already established, God's already established, this is a really poor request. Nevertheless, we got to take their request seriously. I am listening to their request. Samuel, you need to listen carefully as well. But before I grant their request, they need to solemnly be warned, right? They need to understand the gravity of what they're asking. And to do this, God says, what I want them to do is look around them. Look at the other kings around them and see if it's really what they think they want. Okay? So God's finished with his instructions to Samuel, and now the dialogue turns from Samuel to the people. And first we see that, you know, God does exactly like he's instructed. In fact, Samuel speaks all the words of God. And so Samuel basically explains the reality of government to his people, right? And what is that reality of government? Did you pick up on it? The word that was repeated over and over again, 6 times in the 7 verses, the word take. I think that's the word that, you know, God wanted the people to pick up on. The message that government takes, the king will take, right? What will he take? The best of sons and daughters, fields and vineyards, olive groves, seeds, servants, young men, donkeys, and flocks. And he's going to take these sons and daughters and do what? He's going to go off to war with them, and then he's going to tax you, right? And I think 10%, that sounds really good to me, but anyway, you know, so what's also missing from this little passage? He's going to take, doesn't give anything back, right? There's nothing said here about giving back to the people. Well, except one thing, which is kind of sobering here, the very last thing he says about the king, he's going to do what? And you yourselves will become his servants. Wow, I'm going to be enslaved to that king. And what are they giving up? How does God look at them? Well, he looks at them as my people, my bride, my children, my treasured possession, my flock. Wow. What are they giving up to be servants, right? That's sad. This is a really sober warning to the people. And in fact, God goes then, probably the most scary part of this, kind of sends a shudder down my back, and he's not talking necessarily immediately to me, but what does he say? He ends and says, you will cry out in that day because of then you will cry out in those days because of your king whom you have chosen for yourself, but the Lord will not answer you in that day. So God's final words is, once you do this and I give you the king you want, time for listening, my listening, God, my listening is over. I'm no longer listening, and you will live with the consequences of those decisions. And it's not a matter of if, but you will cry out, right? It's going to happen. So clearly God's listened and has warned them, right? The stakes are very dire. And so what can we take away? Well, I guess the question that I thought about here is, well, how would God warn us today if we are making a bad request of him? He's not going to talk to Samuel, right, directly and tell me. How do I see God warning me today? Well, again, from this passage, I think there are 4 ways that God warned them that he can still warn us today. One being the Bible. As I mentioned earlier, Deuteronomy 17, if we go ahead and read 14 through 17, God, you know, recognized that there would be a time where they would have a king reigning over them. And God makes provisions for limits, basically, on what that king can do in terms of citizenship and the military and indulgences and taxes and such. So God made plans for a king. And so, again, God can use his words. I mean, God's words address all of our requests, right? If we'll just look in there and look hard enough, we can find answers to our questions. So God can warn us through his word. We see that here very clearly. The other is seeking godly advice. God can warn us through godly advice. In this case, God sends Samuel to counsel the people. We likewise can go to godly people for counsel. Now, we do need to be careful and make sure we follow up and look to God's word for, you know, with what they have told us. But certainly God uses godly counsel to help warn us when we're moving in wrong directions or asking for wrong things. Another is exactly what God does here and encourages the people to do, and that is to take off their rose-colored glasses, right? So look around you, but look not at just the good. Don't just look at what the kings do around you, but also look at the people and look at what they do to the people and look very soberly at what's going on. And then reconsider your request, not only the good, but the bad sides that you see. And is this really what you want? So God can warn us by opening our eyes as a solemn, a sober look at what's around us. And then finally, probably one of the most eye-opening is that, is it going to enslave you? God warns them, right, that his final warning is, you yourselves will become servants. Will we become enslaved by what we're asking God for? And you might say, well, how is that possible? How could I possibly become enslaved? But a spouse, a job, debt, health, education, position, all these things can enslave us if we're not careful. And so, again, God can warn us through that enslavement if we'll just open our eyes. And as Christians, even more so, to recognize that through Christ we have died to sin, we're no longer its slave. So let us take care not to allow any desire to take the freedom given to us by Christ in Romans 6. So this is something we need to really guard against, that we don't become enslaved, that we take that warning seriously. Okay, so we've seen that, you know, God listens to the heart of our request. We've also seen God listens and warns if we'll only listen. So now we're going to see finally that in listening, God trains and accomplishes. In listening, God trains and accomplishes. And I've added that accomplishes to the notes there. Let's pick up in verse 19. Nevertheless, the people refused to listen to the voice of Samuel, and they said, no, but there shall be a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations, that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. Now, after Samuel had heard all the words of the people, he repeated them in the Lord's hearing. And the Lord said to Samuel, listen to their voice and appoint them a king. So Samuel said to the men of Israel, go every man to his city. Okay, so here we see the dialogue continuing, right? And let's see. Yes, okay. And here we see that the dialogue continues. The dialogue first is the people's response back to Samuel, right? They respond. Samuel said to be sober and look at these things. You've been warned. Now they respond to Samuel. Samuel then goes back to the Lord. And then the Lord gives his final decree, if you will. All this, again, is kind of in a dialogue format. And so the section then, this little part here, begins with the people's response. And we see that it starts with, nevertheless. It's probably not a good way to start, right? Basically, what it's saying is that, you know, although all this really good advice you've given, nevertheless, right? And what is the nevertheless? Basically, it's, you know, the clear contrast between God. God was listening. What did they do? They refused to listen, right? And so, nevertheless, even with all this good information, they refused to listen. And then they further amplify their response, right? Look at how they reply back to Samuel. The first word is no. I mean, it's almost like a three-year-old. No. He didn't even ask a question that called for a yes or no response yet. They say no, right? It's like basically being as clear as they could that, you know, that they're refusing to listen to God. They are totally rejecting his arguments and essentially saying, you know, we don't care. Either we don't think it's going to be that bad, or we don't think that's going to happen, but whatever, damn the torpedoes, go forward. I mean, that's it, you know. It case closed, it's done. In fact, it's turned from a request where we had seen earlier in saying, you know, go back here and say, now appoint a king for us. And how do they say it now? Here in verse 19, no, but there shall be a king over us. Now it's become a demand, right? They're demanding a king. Now they do attempt to kind of fortify their position a bit by adding some reasoning. We want a king to judge over us, but, you know, they have the elders, they have the priests to do that. That's all set up. And we want a king to go out before us and fight our battles, but they have a judge. God raises up judges when they need it. In fact, it's not even the judge who's fighting their battles, it's God in miraculous ways. So what are they to gain? So, you know, they're bad decision, right? And they can't cover it up. Basically, they don't recognize God as their king, and they're clearly rejecting him at this point, right? So, now, they've said their piece to Samuel, and Samuel, again, to his credit, what does he do? Keeps his mouth shut. He doesn't say, you're making a really bad choice or anything else. He goes directly to God, and he prays to God. And in complete contrast, what does God do? God listens and does what the people demand. Now, although he listens and he does as the people ask, he listens, but he doesn't concede his authority. And that's very important. He doesn't concede his authority. He will appoint their king. So God here, although he relents and gives them what he wants, he still retains authority. And using their obstinance, he's going to use it to train them and still to accomplish his will. So our application here, obviously, is that God listens. As God listens, he trains and he accomplishes his will. So how do we see that here? Let's unpack that a little bit so we can understand it a little bit and take this home with us. How does God do that? Well, let's think about more of the positive cases where we make a request to God. How does that look? He can use our request. Sometimes he confirms his will by answering our request in the affirmative, right? He says, okay, I've asked something. He says, okay, I'll give it to you. And so that helps us to understand, this is his will, right? In the same way, sometimes we ask things and he refuses to give them to us, right? And so that, again, helps reveal that that's not his will. So he's training us. We also have kind of the in-between case where we ask for one thing, but God doesn't give us exactly what we're asking for. He gives us something kind of different, right? And so again, he's helping us to understand his will. He's training us on his will. And so in all of these cases, he's helping us to understand how better to ask, what to ask for, What is his will? So he's training us. But in the same time, what is he doing? He's also accomplishing his will, right? By what he gives us, what he provides us. Okay? But the case we have here is very differently, right? This is where the people have rejected God's authority, and they're making a bad request. But God allows the request to go forward. And why does he do that? He does that for a couple of reasons, as we've already discussed. First is training. God wants, is hopeful, right, that the consequences of our bad decision will open our eyes to our sin, that we would repent, and that we would, again, come to God and treat him as our full and supreme authority in our life. So, again, the opportunity to train us, right, to train. We've learned from this bad experience. God allows us to do that. But there's another reason that God allows these bad choices is because that decision plays into God's ultimate will, right? It doesn't just have to be the positive things that we do. Sometimes the bad things we do still play into his bigger will, right, and his bigger plan for us. And that's exactly what we see here in 1 Samuel, right? Spoiler alert, but I think you probably all know how the story ends. What does God do? Even in their bad choice, they choose to have a king. God relents. He gives them the king that they want, and he gives them exactly the king that they want. He gives them the man king, right? He's tall, he's handsome, he's a fierce warrior, becomes one, right? He's the man's man. He, you know, the women swoon and the man tremble around him. That's Saul. And God gives them exactly what they want. However, he has the heart of a man, and eventually he's afflicted by pride. And then he, you know, begins to fully appreciate God's authority, and eventually God rejects him as king. And all of this is playing out just like God warned, right? And just before, this is exactly what happens. God tries to warn them. They fail to listen. God gave them what they want. It's playing into God's plan. Gives them Saul, but then when that fails, what does God do? God gives them the king that he wants. And who is that king? King David, of course, right? The man after God's own heart. And although David makes lots of mistakes himself, yet his heart is always set on God, and he's always working to lead his people to God and to keep God in, you know, as, you know, forefront in their minds. And then because of this, through David, God promises, "Your house and your kingdom will endure forever before me. Your throne will be established forever," in 2 Samuel 7. In other words, God's got this bigger plan. Israel played right into my plans with Saul, but now David. And God will use that to save all mankind for all eternity. So God accomplishes his ultimate plan, even though Israel's making bad choices. So in closing, I just want to make a note of another time that God used man's bad decisions to accomplish his perfect will. Now, once again, it's the Jewish leaders, right? And the people rejecting God's kingship, even with overwhelming evidence, overwhelming warning by way of teachings and miracles. Of course, the Jewish leaders, they're desiring to crucify Jesus Christ, God's very son, the line of David, just as promised. And they want to crucify him, even though he never committed a sin. But through the shedding of his precious blood son, God used the evil intentions of the Jewish leaders to accomplish his will, to bring salvation to mankind and to all who would believe, to call on his name. All right, would you stand with me as we close?